Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with 120 world leaders converging on the United Nations for a week-long general debate and speak with the nation's UN correspondent Barbara Crissett. A longtime foreign correspondent for the New York Times, she will discuss the week's agenda and the prospects for reform at the UN itself, as well as the re-emergence of a Cold War divide on the Security Council over what to do about Syria, which the UN's own envoy described as extremely bad and getting worse. Then, following remarks by Mitt Romney on 60 Minutes about his vague voucher plan, we will look into the role that the future of Medicare will play in the election as the once 20-point lead that Romney had with seniors is diminishing rapidly. Jonathan Oberlander, a professor of social medicine and health policy at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, joins us to discuss the fallout from Romney's remark that the emergency room is an option for the millions without health insurance. Then finally, we will get an optimistic vision of political and social change from best-selling author Stephen Johnson. His new book is Future Perfect: The Case for Progress in a Networked Age, and we will discuss his notion that peer progressives can use the internet to build a society where power is distributed more equally amongst a self-regulated network of peers who contribute to the greater good according to where their strengths lie. Joining us now is Barbara Crissett, who's a writer on international affairs and the United Nations correspondent of The Nation magazine and author of several books on Asia. She was the New York Times chief correspondent in Southeast Asia and South Asia from 1984 to 1991 and later the Times bureau chief at the United Nations. She has also been a diplomatic correspondent in Washington and a reporter in Central America, the Caribbean, and Canada. In 2010 and 2011, Ms. Crissett reported and wrote the State of World Population Reports for the United Nations Population Fund, the first focused on women in post-conflict areas and the second on the world at 7 billion. Welcome to Background Briefing, Barbara Crissett.
Thank you.
And, of course, this convergence of 120 world leaders in New York is referred to apparently as diplomacy's annual trade fair. But, of course, it competes, does it not, with Bill Clinton's global initiative?
It does and it doesn't. I think within the UN family, I mean, there is some connection because, obviously, Clinton is focused on some of the issues the UN is also trying to deal with, for example, Haiti. And a number of issues in Africa on the development side. The debate, and it's not really a debate, you know, it's people showcasing for their home TV networks what their government policies are and what they don't like in the world and what they're proposing. So they kind of overlap in some areas, but you're going to get other issues, nuclear, things like Syria and the future of the Middle East in general. Are issues that really go beyond the Clinton initiative. So that's held at the same time, but it's not competing.
Well,
what's competing is the American election. I will get to that.
Well, apparently that's competing for the president's time. What is happening is being referred to as drive by diplomacy, where tonight he hosts a reception for world leaders, and then he speaks tomorrow, and then he's gone, leaving the rest to his Secretary of State, to Hillary Clinton.
Right. Now, this used to be the pattern over some years, and Obama really reversed this. The Obama administration has been much more plugged into the United Nations, sometimes quietly because of the obvious criticism from those who think that the UN should be not only neglected but moved out of the country. So last year he spent several days, he did a number of things, he spoke at a variety of forums. This year, because of the pressure of the election, and also because some smart foreign leaders know that now is not the time to try to get anything big out of the administration because they just simply want to stay in power, and the real moves will come after November if they're going to be any.
Well, with the exception of Prime Minister Netanyahu.
Well, yes. He obviously wanted to talk to the president. As everyone knows who follows this, relations have not been good between those two people, President Obama and Netanyahu. Can't speak for the whole Israeli population or the American, but the Obama administration's perceived by Romney neglect of Israel the Republicans are trying to use as a campaign issue. So now is not the time, really, to promote a meeting that may not go very well. And this is the case with probably almost everything else. A lot of the contentious issues in the foreign policy debate, such as it is in the United States, are that somehow Obama's being soft on the rest of the world, and that they're not carrying a big stick, they're not threatening war, they're not arming Syrian rebels, and so on and so on. So Obama has to walk carefully at the UN while still making a commitment to taking part in UN activities at a level that hasn't been seen in some years.
Again, I'm speaking with Barbara Cassett, who is a writer on international affairs and the United Nations correspondent of The Nation magazine, and she was the New York Times chief correspondent in Southeast Asia and South Asia and a bureau chief at the United Nations. Now, before the meeting, the general debate convenes this week, Ban Ki-moon, the United Nations Secretary General, said the deteriorating situation in Syria will be foremost on our minds. And then just as the meetings begin, the UN Special Envoy to Syria, Lakhdar Brahimi, says the situation is extremely bad and getting worse in Syria. But it's almost, isn't it, then becomes a kind of metaphor for the UN's inability to deal with the big things on its plate. Nobody, in spite of all the debates that are going to take place, nobody expects any change on the ground.
No, right, not now. And it's not, you know, again, when the UN phrase is used, in this case, it's the UN Security Council. The Secretary General has no power to do what he would or would not want to do in Syria. Lakhdar Brahimi has no power. Lakhdar Brahimi is a very good listener. He's very different from some of the other envoys the UN has used over the years. He, first of all, he's an Arabic speaker, a native Arabic speaker. He can get involved in conversations in a way that some other people can't. But he listens and he thinks it out, and then he offers some suggestions afterwards. He's not a character who walks in with a big plan. And this has been the situation now. But even that aside, he has discovered that, I mean, people are dying by the thousands over a period of time now, and there really is no easy way out for the Security Council, as long as the Russians and the Chinese and others reject the idea of any kind of outside intervention.
Well, apparently the Russians and the Chinese are already balking at a last-minute final document of reform of the Security Council itself. And apparently they feel that references to human rights are tantamount to foreign meddling in their internal affairs.
You know, in many ways, it started with the late Ambassador Richard Holbrooke, who decided in the late 1990s, around the turn of the century, that that it was necessary to start looking at the kind of human issues that really do affect security and international affairs. He, for example, wanted to bring AIDS into the question of what AIDS was doing to African societies into the United Nations. There was horror at this. Then they moved on later on to women, the protection of women in conflict, and more than that, it's not just looking after the women, it's getting them to the peace table. They have to rebuild the societies. They're the key to, you know, a social structure. Again, there were outcries from all over. The Vietnamese were on the council at the time. And I remember asking the Vietnamese ambassador, surely you're not for the abuse of women. No, no, he said, this is not the issue. The issue is these things should never be in the Security Council. They should be in the Economic and Social Council. And that has been pretty much not very productive. So there have been two things, the question of who sits on the Security Council, which is another issue, and then the question of what subjects should come up. And in many ways, the Syrian problem has been bedeviled by Libya. I mean, before we get to the ambassador being killed, this is long ago. The fact that a number of countries, including India, which is supposed to be an ally of the U.S. of some sorts, thought that the Security Council said one thing with Libya, that is human protection, and then did something else. They overthrew Gaddafi. I mean, that is to say the countries. So everything there's a lot of distrust and a lot of fundamental discussion about and dissent about what the Security Council should be doing anywhere at, on any issue, and it's come to a head in Syria.
So what did you witness today, Barbara Crissett? You were in a meeting, right, with some policy wonks, and was Ahmadinejad the...
With Ahmadinejad, the president, yes, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, the president of Iran, met with an absolutely stellar group of American experts on nuclear issues, on U.S.-Iranian relationships, on the Middle East in general. And it was a very interesting meeting. He also spoke to reporters earlier in the day. I was able to go by good luck to the meeting with the American specialists. And his message was, again, giving nothing and asking that the U.S. basically accept Iran as a major power in the Middle East, that the U.S. back off from the Middle East. He reiterated his objection to Israel. He didn't go so far as he sometimes does in crude language, but, you know, he's basically saying the Zionist entity. He doesn't even call it by its name. He simply repeated the fact that he wants respect, he wants power, he wants everybody else to back off and let the great Persian Empire, it amounts to, tell everybody how to run Afghanistan and the Persian Gulf. And so it doesn't leave much space for conversation with him.
So when apparently Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad said that Iran is neutral in the Syrian civil war, did anybody challenging him?
Well, yes. I mean, people asked him for what Iran's policy actually was. He did say, I took one note that was interesting. He did say something about the Syrian people should decide on their own government. Nobody from outside should tell them what to do. And one can interpret that various ways. He wasn't then, that didn't, you know, questions didn't follow up. Was that a slight hint that maybe there's got to be something other than the current regime or not? I mean, we're doing this through an interpreter, of course, because he was speaking in Farsi. So he did leave the understanding that there is a terrible problem there that is not being solved by either the government or the rebels. And, however, he did call attention to the dangers, and I think this is in other countries also, the dangers in that region of allowing increasingly militant organizations to come to the fore in Syria, and that this is going to create, he talked about creating tens of thousands of potential terrorists that could act anywhere in the region, and including in the United States.
But apparently he refused to say whether Iran would accept a government not led by the Assad regime, my understanding.
No, he didn't. He just talked loosely about people choosing their own governments. And, you know, it's hard to say whether he was basically saying, you know, everyone, he basically said the U.S. should back out of the Persian Gulf. This is not new, that Iran kept the peace there for eons, and that it can keep the peace again if everybody just goes away. And the same thing with Afghanistan, that they could do quite a lot. And they did do quite a lot in helping, you know, after the American invasion to try to reconstruct Afghanistan. The Iranians did, I mean, everybody agrees, did play a large part in that. And so he wants really more of a role in Afghanistan as well as the Persian Gulf.
Well, in the last couple of minutes, Barbara Crissett, what's likely to happen this week? I understand Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas is expected to propose to the United Nations that they make Palestine a non-member state.
Right. This is slightly down from what he... I'm sorry, because I've been talking all day. Slightly down from what he asked for last year, which was a seat in the General Assembly and basically recognition as a nation, and that's put very crudely. But this time they want... A step up. They do have observer status at the UN as the PLO, but he wants a step up to recognition as a state with observer status. However, what happened last year could be repeated or not, which is that in the end he backed off, pushing the issue. But he is speaking this week. Ahmadinejad is speaking on Wednesday. Obama speaks tomorrow. There are quite a lot of people. And don't forget the Burmese president who has allowed all these reforms to take place. He's an uncharismatic, much quieter person obviously Aung San Suu Kyi is the heroine, and he will be speaking, I think, next week or at the end of this week. So, you know, there are a lot of things happening in the UN that may not get reported because the Americans will have gone away. At least the president and his group will.
But Dora Aung San Suu Kyi is there, right? She's very much in the limelight, isn't she?
Well, she's around, but you know, she has no
official position
to speak.
Yes,
you know, because the president of Myanmar, Burma, will speak, and she's been around. She met the Secretary General, I think, on Friday. She's been feted around Washington and various think tanks and organizations. She is a remarkable person, and it, you know, deserves the attention that she's getting. But the question is, as Secretary Clinton said, that the purists can't be allowed to push the Burmese, that is the government, too much too fast, or the military could step in again. She doesn't say it that way, but that's the unspoken problem. So praise Aung San Suu Kyi, help her. And Aung San Suu Kyi has gone out of her way to talk about how she's getting along with the president, how she's getting along with the military and in the parliament. And you know, she's turned, as Hillary Clinton talked about her, from a symbol of Burmese freedom to a statesperson, a stateswoman, a statesman. And this is very important for Burma. And so the play between the two of them is going to be very interesting.
Well, just in the last 30 seconds, I'm sorry to rush, but tell me, given that they can't do anything about this bleeding wound of Syria, but there's also serious rumors of war between Israel and Iran, are they going to be talking about that big reality?
Well, they'll all talk about it. I mean, Ahmadinejad took the position today that even if Iran's a big country, he said they can attack us and it won't make any difference. Basically, I mean, they will put out positions. What they call the general debate, as I said at the start of this, is really not a debate. It's, you know, laying out of positions, and so people, you know, sort of comb them for something possibly new, and that's about as far as it will go.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Barbara Cassette.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Barbara Cassette, who's a writer on international affairs and the United Nations correspondent of The Nation magazine and author of several books on Asia. She was the New York Times chief correspondent in Southeast Asia and South Asia from 1984 to 1991 and later the Times bureau chief at the United Nations. She's also been a diplomatic correspondent in Washington and a reporter in Central America, the Caribbean, and Canada. In 2010 and 2011, Ms. Cassette reported and wrote the State of World Population Reports for the United Nations Population Fund, the first focused on women in post-conflict areas and the second on the world at 7 billion. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about how Mitt Romney is losing the senior vote.
So no one would know how tired they've grown of talking and telling their lies. All we've got, no health insurance, no cellular service, no disease they can cure. But we need more money to burn, so each person must learn the dollar amount they are worth.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jonathan Oberlander, a professor of social medicine and health policy and management at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where he's also a professor in the Department of Political Science. A leading authority on the politics of healthcare and healthcare reform, he's the author of The Political Life of Medicare and co-editor of the 13-volume series, The Social Medicine Reader, the second edition. He is currently working on a book project on the politics of health reform. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jonathan Oberlander.
Thank you so much for having me on.
And before Vice Presidential nominee Paul Ryan was booed last week at an AARP meeting down in New Orleans, apparently Mitt Romney was already losing voters amongst the elderly voting group, a key electoral group. I take it your feeling is that If he loses the older vote, he loses the election.
That's right. There's no way that Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan can lose the senior vote and still win the election. If you look at what happened in 2008, seniors were one demographic group that John McCain actually did quite well among. And for Mitt Romney to put together a winning coalition, he's got to have a majority of seniors.
So what explains then the fact that he had a 20-point lead over Barack Obama amongst the seniors, and now he's down to less than a 4-point lead?
Well, the polls are bouncing around a bit, and part of it, of course, has to do with a general bounce in the polls for President Obama following the Democratic convention. But I think it's also the case that this election, in terms of health care, has been a surprising one in that it's focused on Medicare. And Medicare is an issue where Republicans have a particular vulnerability, especially with Paul Ryan as their vice presidential nominee. And Democrats have been, at least to this point recently, winning the Medicare war.
So how did Mitt Romney do on 60 Minutes? That's a huge venue. And again, the questions of Medicare came up. What seemed to be pretty clear was that he made a strong point of saying that he's in charge of the ticket, not Paul Ryan, and therefore it's his vision of Medicare that counts. And then he went on to say that he would have a two-tiered Medicare system. The existing one would be choice A, and a voucher system would be choice B.
Yeah, you know, he's got a political problem, which is that for much of the country, Paul Ryan's Medicare plan is not very popular. And there was a New York Times poll just in the last couple weeks that asked Americans, would you like to keep Medicare as it is now or turn it into what Paul Ryan envisions, a program where people would get a defined contribution from the government? And over 75% of respondents said they wanted to keep it as it is now. Medicare is a very popular program. So Romney is trying to thread the needle and distance himself from Paul Ryan. And one of the reasons, I think, that you don't hear a lot of specifics on Medicare reform is it's difficult for him to get in that Medicare arena and give specifics of a plan, because if he does, he does one of two things. One, he alienates the conservatives who very much view Paul Ryan as a fiscal warrior and as a hero, or two, he alienates independents who aren't going to like the changes in Medicare. So he's got himself in a bit of a box.
Well, when he was asked about taking care of the needy in this country and the uninsured, Romney, this is on 60 Minutes, of course, which many analysts saw as a kind of a, you know, a rehearsal, if you will, for the upcoming debates on October the 3rd, in as much as 60 Minutes had both Romney and Obama on their program last Sunday. So his response, though, to the question about the uninsured was, well, you know, if you have a heart attack, you know, you can still get medical care. They, you know, they don't, you just don't have to, you know, die locked away in a room somewhere, referring to emergency medicine, which is what the interviewer followed up with, which was, wait a minute, aren't you just saying that everybody can go to the emergency, and doesn't that, isn't that incredibly expensive and cumbersome and not a particularly good use of our resources? So there we have it. I mean, that seems to be the headline, that, you know, there's always the ER.
Well, that was a really striking comment, and I think it proves the old adage that you can't outrun your own shadow. Here we have a presidential candidate who has a right to claim credit for health care reform in Massachusetts, who played a big role in advancing health care reform in Massachusetts that has really expanded access to health insurance in that state. And one of the major arguments that Mitt Romney made back in 2006 about the Massachusetts health plan is that we had all these uninsured folks showing up to the emergency room, and people with insurance were having to pay for their care, so it made more sense to mandate them to buy coverage. And Mitt Romney, in the 60 Minutes interview, essentially is walking back a position that he has long held, which is it's better to insure people. And he's echoing what George W. Bush said a few years ago when asked about universal health care in the United States, that we already have it. And it's true that by law, emergency rooms have to screen and stabilize Americans. It's the one place you can go where they have to see you. On the other hand, that care is not free. Hospitals certainly try and charge you for it. And we also know that the emergency room is in no way an adequate substitute for universal insurance. We know that on average, the uninsured in the United States get about 40% less medical care. We know that they have a higher mortality rate. And so, for example, uninsured women with breast cancer die at a higher rate than women with health insurance. So to say that the emergency room is a substitute for universal health insurance, it really bespeaks a level of insensitivity and also is simply inconsistent with what Governor Romney has said in the past.
Again, I'm speaking with Jonathan Oberlander, a professor of social medicine and health policy and management at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where he's also a professor in the Department of Political Science, and he's the author of The Political Life of Medicare. So the other point I think is pretty clear about the emergency room as a last resort or a first resort for healthcare is that by the time you get there, preventative medicine, which is infinitely cheaper than treatment, that opportunity has been lost. I mean, give us a sense. I've always been puzzled, Jonathan, about why the Obama administration have not solved their health care plan and reform, and they've allowed it to be sort of stigmatized as Obamacare. And apparently a lot of the provisions that, you know, when people know about them and start experiencing them, they like them, but they've done an appallingly bad job. And do you think that they've done a job as somebody that's involved in social medicine of pointing out this obvious fact that if you have preventative medicine with screenings and clinics that are much, much more low cost than treatment that happens later after the person's developed, a chronic disease?
It is certainly the case that if you take people with high blood pressure or diabetics or kids who have asthma, it would be much better for the healthcare system to see them earlier and to get them into good primary care rather than emergency room care. It's also true that it costs money to cover the uninsured. We have almost 50 million Americans who don't have any health insurance, and it does cost money. And I think you're right, health reformers and the Obama administration have not been successful in selling the Affordable Care Act. And one of the major problems I think they've had is trying to explain what's in it for people with insurance. Because if we think about the uninsured, they're disproportionately low income. They don't vote at very high rates. And most Americans have health insurance. And so the case that the administration has to make in this election and that reformers have to make beyond the election is what's in the Affordable Care Act that helps people who already have insurance. And the Affordable Care Act is really complicated to understand, but I think one simple way to understand it is that the law makes coverage more affordable and accessible for those who don't have it and more secure for those who do. And it's that latter point that reformers really need to sell.
So what do you think happened to Mitt Romney then, Jonathan Oberlander, in as much as he came up with the Massachusetts health plan that in many ways became a model for so-called Obamacare, and now he's running away from it when, in fact, as you pointed out, one of the ways that he sold it to the voters of Massachusetts was how expensive emergency care is and how we can prevent all this by pooling into a statewide program. I'm just puzzled about this because even more recently, when he was in Israel, he praised the Israeli health care system at keeping medical costs down to 7 to 8% of GDP. As you know, our health care costs are upwards of, 18% of GDP on a $2.8 trillion health care system that doesn't take care of at least 50 million of our fellow citizens. So what's happening with him? Is there two Mitt Romneys here, the private and the public?
I think what's happened is the Republican Party has moved to the right. I mean, to be fair, Massachusetts is a very different kind of state. And if you're in Massachusetts or in California, where Republican Governor Schwarzenegger was also a moderate on health care reform, it's a very different situation than in many other parts of the country, including where I live here in North Carolina. And Mitt Romney was running in a primary election in the Republican Party, which has moved significantly to the right in the last few years, and where healthcare is an absolutely toxic issue, and anything that looks like Obamacare is a death knell of the Republican candidate. So he had to distance himself in that primary, had to distance himself, in effect, from his own plan. And the dilemma that he has is, having done that, at the same time, he's got to try to appeal to moderates and independents who may not like all that's in the Affordable Care Act, but many of them don't want to see it completely repealed. So just as with the Medicare debate, he's got himself in a very difficult box.
So how does he think, as he said on 60 Minutes, that private plans will have to offer the same benefits as traditional Medicare? But he provided no details. I mean, is that possible?
Well,
I mean, one you pay for Medicare, and one, yeah, sorry.
Yeah, the strange thing about this Medicare debate is we already have private plans in Medicare. He and Congressman Ryan have said that their plan would offer more options. And I'm not sure quite what they're talking about, because right now in Medicare, beneficiaries can choose from the traditional Medicare program operated by the federal government or what's called a Medicare Advantage plan, which is a private insurance plan that contracts with the government. And one out of four Medicare beneficiaries or so actually choose those private plans. So we already have private plans in Medicare. We already have choice in Medicare. It turns out those private plans are overpaid by the federal government, and so they're actually adding to the budget deficit. But regardless, we already have that level of choice. So in a way, I think this argument that we need choice in Medicare, that we need private plans in Medicare, is really misleading, because what is the basis of Congressman Ryan's plan is not the addition of choice, but shifting the burden of rising medical care costs to seniors and other Medicare beneficiaries. That's the issue, is who should bear the cost for Medicare reform. And the Obama administration tries to cut payments, low down payments to the medical care industry. Congressman Ryan's plans would alternatively shift the cost of rising care to beneficiaries themselves.
So that's at the heart of this demagoguing that's been going on against so-called Obamacare, saying he's taking money out of Medicare. Well, that's the money that they're talking about, is it's overpayment from Medicare Advantage, is it not?
Yes, that's certainly part of it. They slowed down the rate of increase in payments to hospitals as well. And we should be clear about two things. One is that under the Affordable Care Act, Medicare is still going to grow. Before the Affordable Care Act, it was projected the program was going to grow at about a rate, annual rate of 6.8% a year. After the Affordable Care Act, it's going to grow projected 5.5%. So it's still growing, just not quite as accelerated a pace as it was before the health reform law. The second thing is that controlling Medicare spending and slowing it down is good for Medicare beneficiaries. We know that the Affordable Care Act enhances their benefits and, for example, fills in that infamous donut hole in prescription drug coverage. But as your listeners who are Medicare beneficiaries will surely know, Medicare has a lot of holes, a lot of cost sharing, high deductibles for hospital care, a lot of copayments for physician care. And the higher that overall Medicare spending is, the higher those copayments are. So if we were actually to repeal the Affordable Care Act, as Governor Romney wants to, it would actually add substantially to the costs of seniors and other Medicare beneficiaries.
So again, Jonathan Oberlander, a professor of social medicine and health policy and management at the University of North Carolina, where he's also a professor in the Department of Political Science, and he's the author of The Political Life of Medicare. Let's just change somewhat to the broader issue of how so-called Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, is being implemented around the states. It's a lot of people have noticed that the governor of Arizona, Jan Brewer, who has been a vocal opponent of the Affordable Care Act and a stinging critic of President Obama's health care law, particularly when the Supreme Court upheld it. She called the ruling an overreaching and unaffordable assault on states' rights and individual liberties. Yet we've learned that she is quietly designing an insurance exchange. So, and this is happening throughout the country. So I guess the reality of health care is overwhelming the rhetoric against it.
I think that's right. The fact is that exchanges, which are simply online marketplaces, sort of organized or regulated shopping malls to buy private health insurance, where the uninsured and small businesses would go to buy insurance in a state, think of something like Priceline or Expedia.com, except for health insurance. Exchanges were originally an idea that had very broad Republican support. And the major reason that Republicans have opposed them is simply that they're attached to the Affordable Care Act, and anything that is attached to the Affordable Care Act becomes a source of partisan strife. But there are certainly a number of Republican states and Republican governors that are looking very closely at this idea. And the reason they are is this: if they do not set up their own exchange, by law, the federal government will come in and do it for them. So on the one hand, many of these conservative state leaders are torn because they don't want to participate in Obamacare. They want to boycott anything having to do with the law. On the other hand, they know that if they don't do it, the federal government is going to do it for them, and they would rather do it themselves. So I think if President Obama wins re-election and if the law moves forward, you'll probably see a handful of states that resist and don't implement their own exchange, but many other states, including states led by Republican governors and legislatures, will come to accept the reality of the law, at least in the short term, and implement exchanges.
So, Jonathan Oberlander, what would happen if Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan were elected? What would happen to, I mean, he said he's been emphatic that he wants to repeal Obamacare. What kind of a landscape would we have?
Well, it will certainly be a very different one. He has said that on day one he would move to repeal it. Now, it's not going to be quite that fast, but if Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan win, and if, for the sake of argument, we assume that he will have a Republican majority in the Senate and a Republican majority in the House, there's no question that they can overturn large parts of the law. They probably will not have 60 votes in the Senate, so they won't have enough votes to overcome a filibuster, but they can use a process called budget reconciliation, where you only need a simple majority. And in fact, this is what Democrats used at the very end of the debate in 2010 to pass the final version of their law. Republicans can use reconciliation, and they can't get rid of the whole law because of some of the regulations governing that process, but they can get rid of the major parts of the Affordable Care Act. And we should all keep in mind that most of the parts of the Affordable Care Act that affect access, the Medicaid expansion, the subsidies for the uninsured to buy private coverage, the exchanges, aren't scheduled to go online until 2014. And it's a lot easier to get rid of something before it starts than after people are already enjoying the benefits.
But will that mean then, if Romney and Ryan get in, that they will be able to institute this voucher plan of Ryan's, whether it's Romney's version of Ryan or Ryan's version of the voucher plan?
Right. Good question. I don't think we know the answer to that. How many difficult issues do they want to take on at once? They'll certainly move to overturn the Affordable Care Act. Whether they want to invite a huge fight over Medicare restructuring, I don't know. They certainly can pass that kind of legislation in the House. Whether they would be able to get it through the Senate, we'll all have to wait and see. But we should also not forget about Medicaid. And really, if you look at Paul Ryan's plan, most of the savings in the first two decades are not from Medicare. They're from the Medicaid program for low-income Americans. And that program, of course, is comprised predominantly of pregnant women and children and parents of children, as well as seniors and persons with disabilities. And Paul Ryan's proposed budget would absolutely devastate Medicaid. It would cut it as a share of the national economy by 75%. And so while everybody is paying attention to the Medicare debate, mainly because seniors vote, let's not forget about what is at stake here for Medicaid.
Well, just in closing, Jonathan Oberlander, what's your sense then of how this is going to translate in the closing stretches of the presidential campaign as a central argument? It seems to be picking up steam, and it would seem to be, if the polls are right, if Romney's losing amongst the seniors and he's gone from 20 points ahead down to 4 points ahead, I suspect the Obama people see this as a winning argument.
Absolutely. I'm a political scientist, and our forecasts are not known for being particularly accurate, so I won't make any forecasts. But I will tell you there's no question that you're going to see more attacks by the Obama administration and by Democrats on the Medicare issue. It is an effective issue. It is a wedge issue for them. And I think what will be really interesting to watch is, do we see any ads around the Affordable Care Act? Medicare has taken up a lot of space. Do we see anything on the Affordable Care Act? Do we even see the president come out and try and claim credit for some of the more popular provisions of the Affordable Care Act? That'll be very interesting to watch in these last 6 weeks.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Jonathan Oberlander.
I appreciate you having me on.
Again, I've been speaking with Jonathan Oberlander, a professor of social medicine and health policy and management at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where he's also a professor in the Department of Political Science. A leading authority on the politics of healthcare and healthcare reform, he's the author of The Political Life of Medicare and co-editor of the three-volume series, The Social Medicine Reader, second edition. He is currently working on a book project on the politics of healthcare reform. And we're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with the author of Future Perfect, The Case for Progress in a Networked Age. We don't care. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Stephen Johnson, the author of 7 bestsellers, including Where Good Ideas Come From, The Invention of Air, The Ghost Map, and Everything Bad is Good for You. And he is the editor of the anthology, The Innovator's Cookbook. He is the founder of a variety of influential websites, most recently Outside In, and writes for Time, Wired, The New York Times, and The Wall Street Journal. His latest book just out is Future Perfect, The Case for Progress in a Networked Age. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Johnson.
Hey, it's great to be here.
And you're an optimist. As much as we recognize how hopelessly gridlocked our political system is, and even if President Obama wins this election, he's likely to face a lot of opposition and perhaps even a gridlocked Congress, worse than the one that he has now. So we know how bad that is. What's your suggestion here of how we can create this, what is it, a progressive movement online? Is that what it is?
Yeah, well, it's not necessarily online. I am an optimistic, and I try to write an optimistic book, which is, you know, as I've been talking to people about it since it just came out, there is a bit of a look of, you know, shock and amazement when they hear that. Like, oh my God, there's a giant panda that we've discovered. It's so rare to meet an actual optimist. But I think as difficult as the economic situation is and as difficult as the gridlock political culture is, what I'm trying to talk about in this book is in a sense, a kind of a new political movement that I see happening all around me, that with organizations and individuals that I've really been inspired by over the last 5 or 10 years, that are working in a slightly different mode from either kind of traditional structures of either of the two parties. And sometimes they're using technology, but they're not always using technology. The big thing that's at the center of this is the idea of the peer network. These kind of loose, bottom-up, decentralized organizations without traditional leadership structures that are collaborating on new ideas and solving problems in incredibly creative and innovative ways. And this sounds kind of utopian, right? It sounds like something you might have heard on a Northern California commune somewhere in like the early 70s. But the truth is, peer network architectures are responsible for the internet and the web, and a huge amount of the software that we now use in all of our computers were created by people coming together, collaborating, working on problems without ownership, and sharing their ideas and refining and building on top of other people's ideas. So these solutions, they didn't come from government, they didn't come from big government and, you know, top-down state bureaucracies, and they didn't come from the private sector, they didn't come from big corporations, they came from this other kind of form. And we've seen the results of that. We've seen the way in which the technologies that they built have changed the world and improved all of our lives in all these important ways. And I think we can take that kind of structure and apply it to other kinds of problems.
But the means by which this revolution has taken place, the internet, which, as you pointed out, it evolved out of a government program, or out of DARPA and Defense Department research. But it's, you know, we've had battles over the very nature of the electronic commons, which are ongoing, SOPA and the battle for net neutrality. And there's no question that corporate power in this country wants to control and own the internet and the information highway, as it's been referred to. They want to put toll booths on the information highway. Most people get their internet through the monopolies, either Time Warner or Comcast. And it's worth noting that the country that developed the internet is now slipping further and further behind in broadband availability. For example, the city of Chattanooga, Tennessee, has the best broadband almost in the world as a public utility. So I'm not sure that we've answered the basic arguments over who controls the technology, let alone how to best use it.
Well, I think that's a really good point. I mean, I guess what I would say to that is, you know, think about the SOPA-PIPA battle, right? What was so interesting to me about the eventual, you know, at least temporarily successful derailing of that legislation is when, you know, those bills had huge bipartisan support. I mean, you know, in this age of alleged polarization when Congress can't get together to kind of agree on anything, but both parties were completely in agreement that those laws should be passed, right? And when it collapsed after the whole backlash and the Wikipedia blackout and all that, there was this, you could see in the kind of media response to it, that there was this kind of confusion over who won that battle, right? There was this kind of bizarre sense that they weren't sure if it was a victory for the Democrats or if it was a victory for the Republicans. And I think that's because the core values that we're talking about here, the values of supporting an open, decentralized internet that is not owned by, you know, corporations or by governments, was something that that didn't have a political party. And so that movement kind of seemed to come out of nowhere in a certain way. So I think that's that was the beginning of the peer progressive movement that I'm writing about in this book.
So let's talk about the peer progressive movement then, Stephen Johnson. In describing it, you refer to the famous Miracle on the Hudson, where a passenger jet was struck birds and lost its power, and the pilot, who later became a celebrity, landed the plane on the Hudson, and no lives were lost. The Miracle on the Hudson. How is that an exemplar of this concept?
Well, it's an exemplar of how we have sometimes trouble explaining why good things happen in society. So when here you had this plane that, you know, survived, no one died, and it was this big story, and the way we described it in the press were either we called it a miracle or we talked about this heroic pilot, this kind of superhero, and he was undoubtedly a fantastic pilot and did a brilliant job. But one of the points I was trying to make is that the plane and the kind of assembled technologies and kind of collaboratively created techniques that went into the building of that Airbus that he was flying were also crucial to his ability to land that plane. And there was this electronic system, fly-by-wire, that enabled him to, that was continuing to run even though they lost, you know, thrust in the engines. It was crucial to helping him kind of land the plane at the right trajectory, the right kind of angle of attack to the water, so that it didn't, you know, crash into the water and shatter. And that technology had thousands of people who were involved in creating it. Some of them, you know, kind of in the public sector. Some of them from NASA, from the government. Some of them in the private sector. But it had been, you know, 30 years of all these minds kind of building this technology and collaborating on it to create this extraordinary plane that was able to perform, you know, as well as the pilot did. And I think we just have a problem in society where we're really good at pointing out heroes and visionaries and individual geniuses, but we don't really have great kind of master narratives about group collaboration in that way. And in fact, a lot of progress, a lot of important things in life come from that kind of peer network collaboration.
Again, I'm speaking with Stephen Johnson, the author of 7 bestsellers, including Where Good Ideas Come From, The Invention of Air, The Ghost Map, and Everything Bad is Good for You. He's the editor of the anthology The Innovator's Cookbook and the founder of a variety of influential websites, most recently Outside In. And his latest book just out is Future Perfect, The Case for Progress in a Networked Age. So tell me more, though, about the idea, because I... Obviously, when our audience hears the word progressive, they're thinking of the opposite of conservative. And I take it you're not talking about a political movement, more of a social movement, right, in terms of peer progressives?
There are political elements to what I'm talking about. I mean, you know, one of the places where I think this is most relevant already, and we're seeing a lot of these ideas coming out in practice, is what's happening in local communities and local governance, where people are building tools or not even using technology, but they're creating these systems whereby small networks of people, you know, neighbors in a community, can help identify and solve local problems in their community. So that's everything from the kind of 311 service that a lot of cities are using. I'm in New York City right now, and they have, you know, kind of state-of-the-art 311 service that lets anybody dial 3 numbers on a phone to call in to report problems, report unmet needs, to report things that are not working in the city. And they've created this extended network, basically, where anybody, even though they're not working for the city, they're not on the payroll of the city, but they can be part of this process of making the city work better and more functional and allowing people who are inside government to figure out what the needs are of the citizens. And there are, you know, a million other kind of startups and nonprofit kind of social entrepreneurs who are working on that kind of neighborhood by neighborhood level. And I look at that and I think, you know, this is a really exciting development. On the one hand, it feels progressive in the old sense and the political sense of, about, you know, kind of empowering communities. On the other hand, it's not about big government. It's not about bureaucrats. It's not about a heavy centralized state government. It's about these looser networks of collaboration that I think are really going to be key to reinventing the city.
You mentioned Lawrence Lessig's democracy vouchers here as a part of your argument in terms of peer progressives. I actually do the UCLA Hammer Forum here, moderate it, and he came, and of course we spoke about the enormous amounts of money going into American elections. This will be a $6 billion election, and he is trying to find ways and thinking about ways in a way that most people aren't, about how people can take back their system as America's democracy itself becomes looks more and more like an oligarchy. But there was an effort made by a group called Americans Elect to merge, I guess, network democracy with electoral politics, and it didn't work. What happened there?
You know, I don't really know that story very well. I've seen a little bit about it, but I don't know the real kind of breakdown of why that didn't take off. So I'm probably not I should know more about that case study.
Well,
what Lessig was talking about in democracy vouchers, I think, you know, that's a really good example of that kind of peer progressive solution, where it's not that the state should completely fund elections and just distribute the money evenly. It's fine for individuals to have a say in where dollars go in terms of supporting candidates or supporting, you know, parties. You just want to make sure that there's a big, diverse network of funders and not just a small elite, you know, a fraction of the 1%, as Lessig talks about. And that's what the democracy vouchers, where you're saying, you know, you create a system where people can make $50 of their taxes to support a candidate, and then they can top it off with another $100 of their own. That kind of system empowers lots of people to contribute in kind of like a Kickstarter mode or a crowdfunding mode. But it doesn't just have the state take over the process entirely.
Well, it's interesting in other countries, Stephen Johnson, particularly in China and certainly in Russia, the alternative reality that the young people and educated people are getting from government propaganda, whether it's Putin's control of the media in Russia or the Communist Party of People's Republic's control of all media in China, it is via the internet. So we have examples already of a robust use of the internet as an alternative to state-controlled media. Obviously, the analogies don't necessarily apply here, but in many ways, they do. Isn't one of the reasons why so many people are turning to the internet for their information and away from network news and newspapers is because of what has become known as the MSM, the mainstream media?
Yeah, it's one of the things that I'm you know, optimistic about. I mean, I find personally, just in my own experience, that, you know, when you think about something like watching a political campaign and trying to figure out what's going on, like the period we're in right now, I'm always amazed at the incredible range of ideas and information and kind of direct access to the candidates and different perspectives, you know, the engagement of kind of academics now who are blogging and responding to things who are part of the conversation when they weren't 20 years ago. I mean, it's just a whole ecosystem of news and reporting around, you know, something like a presidential campaign is so much richer than it was when we had, you know, kind of three networks and a couple of big national papers. And the networks and the big national papers are still relevant, but there's just a lot more voices in the conversation now, and I think that's a really good thing.
Well, arguably, the videotape that's had a big effect on the election, and particularly adversely for Mitt Romney, the surreptitious taping of a fundraiser that he had in May in Boca Raton, Florida, where he talked about the 47% that he doesn't care about, the victims waiting for a government handout, a moment of, obviously for him, accidental candor. That is enabled by essentially the fact that now media is in the hands of just about everybody. I mean, we have citizen journalists now. I was just driving through L.A. the other day, and suddenly I was looking at all these people on the street holding up their phones. And, of course, what they're doing was taking pictures of the space shuttle flying overhead. But, I mean, it seemed like everybody was taking a picture. So everybody is a potential newsreel cameraman.
What ends up happening is that you have, instead of this, you know, very clear division between people who are official journalists who have something to say and are able to report on the news, what happens is that kind of blurs, and you get this kind of a gradient where you continue to have, you know, network news anchors and official columnists for the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, and they continue to play kind of a similar role. But then you have these folks who are part-time journalists, and then you have these folks who are academics, but they keep a blog so that they can get involved in the news when it becomes relevant to their particular field, which is a huge advance, actually. And then you have, you know, when you get down to the level of local news, you have citizen journalists, and you have local bloggers, and then you have the people who happen to be standing there when the plane goes down in the Hudson, and they take the first picture on their iPhone. They're briefly, you know, kind of global news reporters, photographers for that one moment. And that's, I think, if you had to design the system, if we were sitting down from scratch and saying, like, how should news work? Should it be a very small percentage of the public who is a full-time professional journalist, or should be this kind of gradient of expertise and involvement? It seems to me that the gradient is a much more effective and interesting and kind of nuanced and engaged way to do it than the old order.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Stephen Johnson.
My pleasure, Ian. Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Stephen Johnson, the author of 7 bestsellers, including Where Good Ideas Come From, The Invention of Air, The Ghost Map, and Everything Bad is Good for You. He's also the editor of the anthology The Innovator's Cookbook, and he's the founder of a variety of influential websites, most recently Outside In. He also writes for Time, Wired, The New York Times, and The Wall Street Journal, and his latest book just out is Future Perfect, The Case for Progress in a Networked Age. And this has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank assistant producer Michelle Manos and producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me on Facebook at Ian Masters Media. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Love.